Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is the 2-hour zero point radio show through BBS Radio. It's mid-late November here, rainy, cold day. Winter's coming on to the northern hemisphere. I run Zero Point, or work under that logo. Zero Point is an institute for mystical and spiritual science. And really, the institute constitutes primarily myself as a writer. I've written, I have 6 books on my mystical studies, which I self-publish. And I maintain the website at www.zeropoint.ca. I think my work represents a unique perspective on the nature of human existence. And it's based upon a synthesis of different esoteric, mystical, and spiritual ideas on the one hand, with modern scientific ideas and data on the other hand. So the work, my interest is in mystical and spiritual science, because I claim, firstly, that mysticism and spirituality, they are not simply belief systems, but rather there is a scientific nature to such teachings. That in a way they embody what I would call the science of the soul. The word, I'm a PhD clinical psychologist, and I was a professor for 12 years in Toronto, and then worked in corrections with offenders, adult and young offenders in Ontario for 12 years. And then about 4 or 5 years ago, I left and devoted myself to trying to develop my books and my website and to get this teaching out into the world. I think it's particularly relevant in modern times and serves to synthesize other ideas and help us see some of the mistakes we're making in modern thought and understanding, and to arrive at a kind of higher dimensional understanding of the nature of human existence. So what the teaching is really complex. It's not something a person can simply grasp, but we grasp it by levels and stages and phases and have new insights and such as we are on the path. And that awakens us to different levels of understanding and knowledge. So, in the background, Jim Moffat is a co-host, lives in Toronto, has been a lifelong friend. We met in high school, and so Jim's been studied in my work, and we've worked together and studied together, and Jim's a writer in his own right, with about 3 or 4 books now, which he's not self-publishing at the moment. So Jim is really the one, I would say, who most understands what my work is about and appreciates its value. Jim, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Your comments before the show, you mentioned there was something you wanted to kind of pick up on a little bit. I didn't want to let that go.
Two weeks ago, our program unfortunately got curtailed, cut short, and
BBS lost its power.
It was interesting too, because it was a good beginning. We were going to talk about Irvin Laszlo's book Science and the Reenchantment of the Cosmos, The Rise of the Integral Vision of Reality is the subtitle. And at the beginning, I thought it was a really good presentation that you made about it probably made more sense to me than to anybody else, but it conveyed something really important, I think, about the nature of the theoretical work that you've done over the past 40 years, and that you've the model of consciousness that you've developed, and you identified some of the differences of what you thought were the primary differences between your work and that of others who study consciousness and who even the differences between your work and that of people who are sympathetic or who incorporate mystical and esoteric ideas into their models of consciousness or their reflections on the nature of consciousness. And one of the primary things that you discussed was the importance of the heart doctrine versus the head doctrine, and the basic thesis that you put forth is that consciousness is not generated by the material processes of the head brain, but rather consciousness is something that originates in higher dimensional realities, and it manifests through the heart, through the metaphysical heart, and then through the physical heart, and provides the light by which the workings of the brain are illuminated and give rise to conscious experience. And this idea that the heart is the source of life and consciousness within a human being is very interestingly is repeatedly articulated in various esoteric and mystical teachings throughout history. Even for someone like myself who has a more than a passing knowledge of mystical and esoteric ideas, I was quite shocked when you started to articulate this idea about 20 years ago now, I think, that you started to write about this, maybe even a little bit earlier. But I was really quite shocked when you started developing this and you kept adding material as you refined your books, is that how prevalent these ideas are there. It's kind of there, but in a sense, people don't see it. And even people who know of these teachings and who will quote them and comment upon them don't seem to recognize as important to the heart doctrine. So I think this is a very, very, very unique aspect of your work, which is very different from anything I know of in which people talk about consciousness. I mean, there's somebody like Adi Da, a modern master who certainly articulates the heart doctrine and has profound commentaries upon his own interpretation and understanding of it, but for the most part, I don't think anybody with an academic background, and I don't think anybody who writes about consciousness issues from a sympathetic, mystical, esoteric perspective, I'm thinking of a guy like, for instance, Ken Wilber, or even for Irvin Laszlo in his book, his books that I've read, I see how they don't see this, that they don't recognize the importance of this. I think this is a major element which has to be considered to further the development of this new paradigm that people talk about that's emerging in the study of consciousness and physics, and how psyche and cosmos are somehow related, and what the possible interconnections are. And then another central element that you talked about was the importance of the idea of the zero point drawn from Madame Blavatsky's The Secret Doctrine, and how zero points are, it's an interesting concept, it's an intriguing concept, but it suggests that somehow material creation is rooted into and manifests out of the higher dimensional realities, what in modern science is recognized as a quantum vacuum, and these different dimensions of consciousness and being, and that this is manifested, the manifestation of our physical observable world is somehow informed through zero points, which are these points which are so infinitesimally small that they're beyond measurement, that they're they pass into another dimension of reality by virtue of their minuteness. And at the same time, they're portals. You can think of them as portals through which various beings manifest out of these higher dimensions. And then I can't really remember what the third thing you talked about was, but I think
it was on like the kind of mathematics of creation.
Oh, yeah,
the basic 137.
Yeah, very good. Yeah. And how we have to think in terms of these, what Gurdjieff calls these cosmic laws, laws three and laws seven, but also like how it's a very complicated concept, like the idea of these cosmic laws, but also like it's applicable on a variety of levels, and it applies to the functioning of the normal human psyche, wherein we tend to see everything in twos and are third force blind, and this is a very profound psychological idea which requires a great deal of consideration in order to begin to grasp how profound it really is. And then I would say globally, I think that one of the things which is implied in everything that you said, but which you didn't identify, and I see more and more how people miss this too, is that then you and I began this journey about 32 years ago, I think now.
Yeah.
We started studying the fourth way teaching of G.I. Gurdjieff and P.D. Uspensky and other prominent students of the fourth way. And Gurdjieff and Uspensky are adamant that one of the things that I realize this is so important is that in order to study consciousness, you have to study it by studying yourself. That the proper field, the proper method of study of consciousness is self-study, but not self-study in a sort of a willy-nilly or half-assed fashion, but in terms of a system. And this is what Gurdjieff says, is you have to systematically study yourself in order to observe your consciousness, and in his terms, in order to understand the most prominent feature of consciousness, is that our normal waking consciousness, it should be understood to be a waking sleep. This is really a profound idea. And I in Laszlo's book, for instance, I in page 2 of the introduction, he says that he's talking about the re-enchantment of the cosmos as a coherent, integral whole comes from the latest discoveries in natural science, but the basic concept itself is not new. And he says, you know, this has been known for thousands of years through the commentaries and the study of medicine men, priests, shamans, seers, and sages, and to all people who had the courage to look beyond their noses and stay open to what they saw. But then he says, theirs, however, was the kind of insight that comes from mystical, religious, or ascetic experience that was private and unverifiable, even if it appeared certain beyond doubt. I completely disagree with that. I think that's a complete misrepresentation of the esoteric tradition. I think the esoteric tradition, yes, by definition, the study of consciousness within yourself is a private event, but it is verifiable because it's been verified by the fact that people observe the same processes and abstract the same concepts and have the same experiences.
You have repeated kind of observations, confirmation of the teachings.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And this is
so it is empirical evidence.
Yeah, and that's the word. It's empirical. It's based on observation. And for me personally, that was what really appealed to me when I first started studying the Gurdjieff work, was that I'm essentially an empiricist. If I can't observe it, I have a difficult time just taking anything on faith. I'm scientific in that sense. I'm an empiricist. But I don't believe that the empirical is restricted or limited to the external observable world. I think we can observe our inner world, and that's been the real glaring fault in modern psychology is that it assumed that we can't do this, whereas the esoteric teachings reveal very profoundly that not only can we do this, but we have to do this to study consciousness. So, in a sense, the more I reflect on a couple of things, number one, the study of consciousness, number two, the striking and glaring limits of materialism as an explanation of phenomena. It can't really account for life or consciousness. It's very good as a tool in making repeated and useful observations about the material physical world, but as a comprehensive explanation, it's completely not as advertised. It lacks in addressing the fundamental issues, and it really takes away. It's illusory in the sense that it blinds people to the fact that we are multidimensional beings who exist in a multidimensional universe.
Yeah.
And I see more and more, and you know, it, perhaps others would say it's folly to do, but I see that how important your work is in terms of really explicating these incorrect assumptions in modern science and psychology about the most fundamental of issues. In Stanislav Grof's paper in Laszlo's book, there are papers by a number of people commenting on Laszlo's work. And Stanislav Grof, who's a very famous psychiatrist known for his work in holotropic breathing and holotropic reality, who's studied consciousness for 50 years and is a very interesting theorist, says that Ken Wilber expressed in his writings the need for an integral theory of everything and outlined what such a theory should look like. However, the credit for actually creating such a theory goes to Irvin Laszlo, arguably the world's greatest system theorist and interdisciplinary scientist and philosopher. Okay, well, I reread Science and the Reenchantment of the Cosmos, and I have read his book on the Akashic Field. And Laszlo has a lot of interesting observations, but I would say that that your work is really quite light years beyond his in terms of dealing with some really fundamental issues about the... I don't see that Laszlo recognizes the multidimensional nature of human being or the multidimensional nature of the cosmos, and I don't think he sees a lot of central facts of the mystical perspective. Like, he's certainly sympathetic to it, and he globalizes it. But as I say, for him to make that statement at the beginning that these were, that it's only the result of recent scientific efforts that we can verify these things is completely wrong in my interpretation of things, my understanding based on your work and our work. And I mean, the thing about your work is that I think it's a brilliant synthesis of thousands of years of efforts on the behalf of others. I mean, I wouldn't be as adamant as I am about the value of your work if it was just something that you had theorized. But what you've done is that you've taken these geniuses from the past and you've integrated them and you've created this dialogue and with modern scientific research and with modern psychological research, and you put it in a completely different framework. Like, I see more and more the value of the model that you've been developing and how it really opens our understanding of what it means to be human to include the whole cosmos, and it puts everything on a completely different footing from that which exists, I think, in most of the theories. I find most of the theories I read, most of the commentary I read, is stuck in the head doctrine. I see that as a major...
Yeah, even
major...
in Laszlo, which is
totally in Laszlo.
Valuable in ways, but he always kind of assumes consciousness is connected to the
head.
Mind,
yeah.
And then the brain and the head. Even when he recognizes the mind is immaterial, it's still kind of connected to the mind and the head. He doesn't take a human being as a whole.
Yeah, and he sees at one point he talks about how these higher order phenomena of consciousness are generated by lower levels of consciousness. And occurring within the brain. And it's interesting because I think he's really, really kind of missed the boat. But in one of the commentaries that follows the biologist Elizabeth, I forget her name. I really like her work, and I should know her name. Sartaris. Anyway, she makes this comment, which is really, really interesting, where she's talking about how, which is very similar to what Elizabeth Sartaris. She talks about the need to understand that there are causal processes that are from the bottom up, and there are causal processes from the top down,
and then
there are horizontal causal processes. Now, this is very much like what Gurdjieff says in terms. He says we have an evolutionary current, which is the development from the simple to the complex, and I would say that that's a fundamental assumption. Unrecognized assumption within almost all modern psychological and scientific theory. Everybody keeps talking about how things evolve or emerge from lower processes, but at the same time, it's very clear, and I mean, there are, even in neurology, there are people who recognize this, like I believe Roger Penrose's work is about top-down causality. But anyway, there are also processes on a cosmic level, on a personal level, which are involutionary processes. They start from a higher order of coherence and complexity, and they devolve. They become increasingly simple and more diverse, actually the better term. So in Gurdjieff's terms, you have these two currents, like the evolutionary current and the involutionary current, and then you have within that construction, you also have like lateral processes that occur side octaves in his terminology. And I think that that's something that Laszlo definitely doesn't recognize. It's so interesting that she says that in the commentary about his book. But
that's a very interesting point.
I see that.
Just
very important.
I'd like to comment on that a little bit more. A couple things actually, because you said so much about
different
things.
That's actually what all I wanted to say. So.
Well, why don't I pick up on that, and then we'll come back. And just first to go back, you were talking about consciousness and kind of. I remember reading Nickel in Gurdjieff Uspensky student. He kind of says, we live in two worlds. There's kind of the inner world and the outer world. And that's, you know, the scientists think, well, you focus on the outer world and observe things outwardly. And that, so you study the outer world. And then you're saying esotericism is about the study of the inner world. And Nickel asked, in what world do we really live? And in a way, our inner world is the most primary. Inner world, that's the world in which we live. So we have to study the inner world as a way of understanding consciousness and what is the nature of the mind and what is the nature of self. So we have to attain self-knowledge through inner study. And as you commented on that, it struck me also that another aspect of the materialist, like delusion, is the kind of belief that you can study what the outer world is without thinking that your faculties of consciousness and mind, which apprehend the outer world, are part of what the outer world is. Like the outer world isn't simply something outside. It's what's outside as experienced through your own nature. So even that, I would say like a false dichotomy of modern times. Is it, in a way, Nickel, there's the inner world and the outer world. And no, they're not separate worlds. They're interrelated. That was one point I had. And then just to come down, it's interesting. You're saying about Laszlo kind of assumes, how in the Gurdjieff teaching we talk about involution and evolution. So in the beginning, when God kind of in the beginning creates the worlds on different planes of existence and then manifests, say, as a stone. So God becomes a stone. I remember Gurdjieff talking about that in Search of the Miraculous. You know, like, what are all the different levels between God and the stone? Okay, so that, Gurdjieff would say, is involution. A higher dimensional intelligence, life force, and manifests outwardly in material form. So that's involution. And then once the material worlds are created, then beings can evolve, which is develop from the simple, what's been created, evolve into more complex forms, which in a way can reascend. Can possibly attain the evolution of man to return to the source. So the distinction between involution and evolution is so important, and modern scientists don't think of that at all. They think any change is evolution. And so they don't have the other concept of involution. It struck me I had another insight that as you were speaking, because you were saying about how Laszlo kind of assumes in his book that the kind of change and evolution is from the bottom up, that the material produces the psychical and the consciousness and so on, and how the other author talks about creation from above down, so top down. And then it struck me that, in a way, in my work, in a way represents a third perspective. Because in a way, that up and down, the hierarchical, I'm suggesting things are created within, without. So it's not higher or lower, it's more within or without. So it's kind of manifesting within, without, from zero points. That's the title of my book series. So things, cosmoses, emerge from zero-point sources, and they grow within, without, from zero points, and they become beings of different kinds. So it's not just top-down or down-up, but really it's within, without, and that's like a whole kind of new way of thinking, and that takes you into the kind of physics of higher dimensions. understanding that it's within without rather than from above below.
Yeah, although in a sense, like, I mean, that's just a metaphor, the higher and lower,
yeah.
I think, properly understood, because you're talking about things that are really non-local, and so which our normal dimensional, you know, vectors don't really apply, but it's a good point about within, without, because it's more interior, the more interior, the higher, in a sense, you know, so,
yeah,
that's a very good point.
Yeah, it's like a third alternative again.
Yeah. That's another thing too that this is where I don't see in Laszlo's work the recognition, and again in one of the discussions there's a very good discussion by De Quincey in the book about the concept of hierarchy, but he doesn't sort of address the idea of a multidimensional universe. Like, he talks about the quantum vacuum or the Akashic field, which he equates it with from Hindu cosmology, and he says there's, you know, this void plenum which is informing and manifests as material creation, but it's sort of like it's dualistic in a sense. Like there's that and there's this, but
the void and the plenum, yeah.
And the material world, but it like realistically, I think in terms of esoteric cosmologies and esoteric psychology, there are all these intermediate steps. Like there's seven levels is typically the, you know, the framework in which you discuss these things.
It's like there are seven levels to the plenum. The void plenum. There are seven levels to it. This is so important. Like Laszlo's whole book, the most important concept is that there is this ultimate ether. And he even uses Blavatsky's term, Akasha.
Yeah,
which is the primordial source of all things. So he has the concept of that and how all things are correlated within the plenum, within this zero-point field that pervades things. So he has that concept. But Blavatsky has furthered the concept that the void plenum is seven-dimensional. So she's not only saying, yes, there is an ether, but she calls it the seven-skinned eternal parent space.
Yeah.
So she says it has seven skins. And this concept of the seven-skinnedness of the ether is again an idea found within Kabbalistic teachings, Vedic teachings, Gurdjieff, Blavatsky, and elsewhere. So this sevenfoldness of the ether. So there again, like he, you know, he's climbing the rung of realization, you know, he's kind of got the first levels of it. He's got really brilliant ideas in terms of understanding the quantum ether or the Akasha and how he recognizes that information is a third force in science. And that's not been recognized because traditionally we had that duality of matter and energy. Everything is material or energetic. But now there's information, which doesn't have mass. It's not energetic, but it informs and it guides the manifestations of matter and energy. So reality has this triune nature rather than the old duality of materialist science. I lost my track a little bit, but one last thing I wanted to mention was that he also, in his book, you realize that the idea, basic kind of stance of materialism itself is completely illusory. And modern science has proven that. Like, reality is not simply material in the way we think it's material, like composed of solid substances.
Yeah.
And the more you go into matter, he gives, at one point he says, creation is 0.99999999 and maybe a few more nines, empty space.
Yeah.
And that's what physics shows. So hard science itself shows this concept of materialism is like totally superficial on a scientific basis. In a way, modern science, you can't be simply a materialist in modern science. It's to deny all the advances of science. Creation is not simply material in the way we used to think it was.
Yeah, and the whole history of 20th century physics, I mean, the search for the primary building block of matters was chimerical, because there is no such thing. As you basically, what you have is relationships and possibility, probabilities, and there is no real thing about, you know, there's no little tiniest billiard ball which is, everything is composed of, you know. So,
well, it's funny, in a way, see, I say there is in a way. Like, because, like, yeah, I would argue there is, in a way. Like, the monads are,
yeah,
like, the fundamental,
well,
building.
Okay.
Well, they're not the building blocks.
Yeah.
No,
yeah,
they're not the building. No, you're right. There's no fundamental building block.
It's not really, I don't think, and it's not material in the traditional sense.
No.
But I guess the other thing, too, is that, you know, he mentions Whitehead and Freeman Dyson say that, you know, they have panpsychic beliefs, which is that you know, everything on some level, and this is, again, like with Gurdjieff, possesses some level of consciousness,
mm-hmm,
material. But one of the things about matter, the more I think about it, the more I realize, like, this whole, I've been reading about stuff about genetics, and I've been reading Mario Beauregard and Denise O'Leary's book on the spiritual brain, and it's a really good critique of materialism in that book, but it's just sort of reinforced for me the idea that, you know, what's forgotten about materialism is that you really can't, that, There is no thing. This is what Whitehead says, is that everything is essentially a process, eh? Like, even what we regard as being material is really, it's an event. You know, it's a manifestation. Materiality is a manifestation over time of something which we regard as material, but it's really an event, you know, because it passes and then this thing dissolves, right? So, in a sense, like, there is really, in terms of human beings, this is certainly true about the molecules in our body, you know, like, that really what we are is, that Gurdjieff's model of what we are is much, much more akin to the reality of the situation. He says, like, we're chemical and alchemical factories, and that we're taking in air and food and psychological impressions. And so, all the molecules in your body are turning over, you know, like, some in as little as 3 or 4 days, that other things over 6 months, but everything is manifesting and exists for a certain period of time and then disappears. So you've got to go beyond, in terms of the continuity of a human being, you've got to go beyond the material and try to understand what is the nature of the intelligence which is guiding this and which is keeping all of this incredible order, this incredible complexity intact, because a human being is comprised of all these different systems which are interacting and are composed of material processes or material entities on some level, but they're also events, so they're all passing giving way to a new order. So, like, for instance, that, just like, you know, if you see somebody's face and you haven't seen them for 6 months, all the molecules are gone, and yet the face retains the same order. And this is like the central enigma, one of the central enigmas in biology, is like, what's going on there? Like, what is the nature of the intelligence which is maintaining this? It's not in the intelligence isn't in the in the cells, or in the molecules,
or in the genetic material,
material, because even the genetic material itself is temporary, you know. So,
and it's organized. It's like it's organized by fields of information.
Well, absolutely.
Like, they've never,
yeah,
been able to explain, like,
yeah,
well, how do certain cells know to become kidney cells, and,
yeah,
other cells know how to become brain cells?
Brain cells.
That there's,
yeah,
some deeper kind of information or intelligence field which organizes the differentiation of the cells into the living being.
Yeah,
and
the problem of morphology in biology is
yeah,
what
we're thinking of Sheldrake's work.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
the
problem of morphology, how is,
like,
form created.
And it's like interacting fields too, because you have, like, I mean, I think that's where the idea of the chakras is so important, is that you have these different centers of intelligence which are guiding and organizing things on different levels and manifesting in the physical body, but also in terms of consciousness and life. The question is, if you're a materialist and you believe that consciousness and life come from dumb, non-sentient matter, how do you explain that jump, you know? Like, I mean, and you can call it an emergent property, but they basically that's just a term to disguise a fundamental mystery and enigma, and really one which makes absolutely, you know, which when you really look at it, you just cannot justify that concept. No matter, you know, like people like Rupert Sheldrake can write all the, or not Rupert Sheldrake, Richard Dawkins can write all their books they want about selfish genes and everything, but we are not a product of our genes. I see more and more how that those ideas are completely illusory, and how the media, Beauregard's very good on this, how he says how the media seizes on these explanations. You know, scientists announce that we have a gene for this, we have a gene for that. But, I mean, no human characteristic is the product of any one gene. You know, genes interact. But even in the interaction of our genes, we can't really explain human beings in terms of strictly biological processes, strictly material biological processes. I mean, in a sense, biology reduced to materialism is like describing something without having the essence of it. Like life is the essence of biology, right? You know, so it's like, it doesn't make any sense. I see more and more how like that's a complete lie. You know, and it's completely illusory and has to be challenged.
There's such valuable evidence in genetic, like understanding in genetic studies, but it's misinterpreting what that is then. Like, to me, what strikes me, one of the most profound teachings is Blavatsky's teachings. She says that the lunar tritus, the lunar intelligences, which are intelligences on one plane of matter, they form the outer man. They form the material body. So imagine the lunar prithis. Their intelligence is embodied in genetic structures which give rise to the material body. But then Blavatsky says the solar prithis, or solar intelligences, form the inner man or being. So that there's this inner being that's then embodied in the body of flesh. But the lunar intelligences create kind of, are part of the mechanism of the creation of the DNA, but the solar prithis are connected to the inner man. And that's why in mystical studies, the aim is, and in Gurdjieff, is for us to attain the level of the sun within ourselves. And the attaining the level of the sun within ourselves is attaining the state of self-consciousness, of that level of I that's connected with the experience of I, to attain that level of the solar intelligence within ourselves. I remember Nicol once saying, man is created on earth as an experiment, and he can die and feed the moon. And in the Gurdjieff teaching, when anything dies, its soul is said to pass to the moon, that we feed the moon, or a certain energy connected to the soul feeds the moon. And the beings can actually pass to the moon as a realm of existence. Gurdjieff talks about the dark side of the moon, kind of the most remote point in our solar system. So beings actually can pass into the lunar world and death. Lunatics are drawn into the lunar subterrestrial world. Whereas others at death want to attain to the sun, the level of the sun. And then the sun itself might be a portal into even a higher dimensional world beyond the sun. So we want to attain to the sun. We see that in Surya Yoga, which is the yoga of the sun. We see that in Blavatsky. We see that in Gurdjieff. So the idea, the sun is not only this external manifestation in the sky, but it's also a level of consciousness within ourselves, and that level of consciousness within ourselves is connected to the material sun out there, that these things are interconnected.
Yeah.
Gurdjieff provides an absolutely fascinating model, like the ray of creation is really, like it's such a profound depiction of the holographic nature of reality. Yeah, I remember, like, Gurdjieff in The Ray of Creation, you kind of begin in the absolute. And he says it's under one law. It's absolute. It's unified, perfect unity. And then it manifests a threefold nature. So in the first world order, is said to be under three laws. It's like the manifestations of the gunas out of the nothingness. Or the creation of the three pillars of the tree of life in Kabbalistic teaching. So you have your first world order has a triune nature. And then the second world order has six laws. It has the first three laws from the first level plus a further manifestation of those forces to create six laws. And then the next world has 12, and the next 24. And 48, and 96, and 192, that there are all these creation of these worlds on different levels of vibratory creation, and it has a sevenfold structure. And Gurdjieff asks, his worlds are actually, the first is the absolute, the second is all worlds. So it means like all galaxies, all the worlds in the universe are under the three laws at that level. And then the next world under six would, for us, in our ray of creation, it would be our galaxy. Because we live not only in all worlds, but we also live within a particular galaxy. So the level of six laws is like existence within our galaxy. And then the next level, under the law of 12 laws, is within our solar system. Because the galaxy is huge with all these different suns, but we're in a particular solar system with a particular sun. So the sun, to us, represents the world under 12 laws, this higher dimensional kind of world. And then beyond that, he says, the next world under 24 laws is the level of the planets. Because the planets revolve around the sun, and they're involved, he says, in the astral worlds, the level of the astral worlds. So and their influences of the planet, he says, are conducted through the atmospheres and through the electromagnetic radiations and such. So at one level, we are connected to the planets, and Gurdjieff connects the level of the sun and the planets to what he calls our essence. Our essence originates out of the sun and is influenced by the planets, as in astrology. And then the next world order is the level of the earth, which is under 48 laws. And that's connected in the human being to their personality, to the conditioning factors in the world around them and how that essence is influenced and conditioned by the material realm. So that the personality is the earth-based ego, kind of. And then the next law level is the level of the moon. And it is said to be under 96 laws. So if you're under 96 laws, like that's really being under a lot of laws. You're very conditioned and controlled and limited by the number of laws you're under. If you're under the influence of the moon, you're said to be under 96 laws. And in a way, you become a lunatic. You have a kind of a false reality. And then he has a final level of the ray of creation, which is like the nothingness. So Gurdjieff has these seven levels of creation that manifest out of the ether. And he says, in what world do we live? And then he points out, we live in all worlds simultaneously. We live within all worlds, we live within our galaxy, we live within our solar system, we live within a realm of planetary influence, we live on the Earth, and we live in a realm defined in relation to the movement of the moon around the Earth. So we live in all these worlds simultaneously, and all of them are connected to something in us, and this is kind of the mechanism of this kind of holographic universe, that we are connected, interconnected to the larger universe, and the forces of the universe manifest in what we are. So these are all levels in ourselves. So we want to attain to the level of the sun instead of becoming a lunatic and now upon death passing to the moon. It's an amazing, so I'm just saying, Jim, as a model of the kind of hierarchical holographic nature of the ether, there's nothing like the ray of creation.
Yeah, well, one of the things that's really interesting about what he says, too, is that, you know, as you ascend from through this ray of creation, you go up to each level, the material becomes more and more refined, and that really that these worlds interpenetrate. So like as he says about the sun, he says there's no need to go to the sun. The sun exists within all the matter. It permeates all the matter that composes the earth and the rocks and the sand and the buildings that we live in. It's all sort of here. So in a way, he's presenting this model of creation, which is in essence addresses the issue of non-locality. I mean, it really provides a model which 100 years ago anticipated the idea of non-locality, and which really provides an understanding, and then relating it also to the idea. This is something else that I've noticed that I think is really lacking in Laszlo's book. Is there's no recognition that we have these higher being bodies, the astral, the mental, and the causal, and that in order to rise to these higher levels, we have to, in Gurdjieff's terms, we have to coat these higher being bodies. We have to develop some sort of permanence in these higher being bodies by refining our consciousness and by accumulating the finer materials that allow us to be conscious in these higher being bodies. And when we're in these higher being bodies, we're in these higher worlds to which they correspond, and we're under less laws, so we're freer. And that's how, like, it provides a scheme where, when you read about mystics and masters, about them being able to do things and to know things that are beyond normal human faculties and beyond the normal human psyche, it's because they've developed these higher being bodies and they're under fewer laws that they can actually work these miracles and understand these things that people in their normal waking state can't understand.
Yeah, that's so profound, eh? The idea of the higher being bodies, like, that's so profoundly important in to our study.
Yeah.
It reminds me, it was funny because this is, I had thought today of lecturing, we went off.
Yeah.
Been excellent discussion on Laszlo and such. And I'd want, before we came on air, I'd planned to speak about the science of the soul. And in Gurdjieff's classic tale, Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, this is one of the most astonishing books of the past century. It's one of the two classics of modern esotericism, along with The Secret Doctrine. It's a phenomenal book, Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson. It's very esoteric. But what it is, essentially, is the science of the soul and the science of mystical creation. And in that, Gurdjieff, at one point, he's a character who was supposedly sent to our solar system because he interfered. He's like a fallen angel. And he was sent to our solar system because he interfered somehow in the world, the kind of maintenance of the cosmos, and interfered where he shouldn't have. So he was banished to our solar system. And in the story, he lives on the planet Mars, and he sets up a telescope on the planet Mars. And in the book, Gurdjieff visits the Earth 6 times during the story at different periods in human history, the first of which begins with Atlantis. And the 6th visit is in Gurdjieff's period of Gurdjieff's writing, which was like the early 19th or 20th century, in the early 1900s. And he visits America and Germany and other places. So Gurdjieff is this kind of character living on Mars who visits the Earth at different times in human history. And at one point in the story, Gurdjieff he's visiting at the ancient time of Babylon, where he says all the scholars and experts kind of had been assembled in the city of Babylon. And I think there's even a historic basis to that. Is there not, Jim?
Yeah.
Yeah, that some one emperor kind of like gathered all the intellectuals and such in Babylon. It's like creating that tower to God or something. So it's, but anyway, and in, he says in this period of time, it became what he calls the burning issue of the soul. That was the burning issue. And he says there were two classes of people, mainly those who were atheistic and believed there was no God and there was no soul. And then there were the people who were deistic and believed that there was the material world and the spiritual world. So they had a dualistic view. And then Gurdjieff explains a third perspective. He says, a human being, there is a soul, but in a way, a soul is not given to a person. That in a sense, we have to attain to our soul. We have to acquire our soul. And there's certain psychology. How do we acquire our soul? And acquiring our soul is developing, what Jim earlier had mentioned that set me off on this, the higher being bodies. That we have to develop the astral body and the mental bodies, the higher being bodies for the life of the soul. So Gurdjieff is neither kind of theistic or deistic. He says, like, we don't automatically have a soul, and it is not the case that there are no souls, but it's a question that we have to acquire our soul. And Gurdjieff has a story elsewhere in a book by Fritz Peters on the boyhood with Gurdjieff. And Gurdjieff says that when Peters recounts a story, he says, as a young boy, he looked after Gurdjieff in his quarters in his institute in France in a period around 1920s. And Gurdjieff asked him to look out in the yard. There was a big oak tree. And Gurdjieff asked what was around the oak tree. And Fritz Peters, as a boy, said, well, there are acorns, nuts, all that spread on the ground around the oak tree. And Gurdjieff asked Peters, as a young boy, he said, how many of those acorns will become oak trees? And Peter's kind of like, was taken aback. And he said, well, maybe only a hand few. You know, and then Gurdjieff says, none of those acorns become oak trees. They don't, see, the acorn doesn't fulfill its possibility of becoming an oak tree. And then Gurdjieff says, so what happens to the nuts? And what happens to them, he says, they become fertilizer. That they break, but the elements in them deteriorate, and they go back into the ground to become possibility for future life. So in a way, human beings are like nuts. And most, if you look at contemporary life of humankind, you can't imagine that human beings are anything other than nuts. But we do have that possibility of attaining, like manifesting and attaining our soul, developing our higher being bodies and learning of our true nature as higher dimensional beings. And then maintain consciousness after death in a coherent way through other planes of existence. Otherwise, we become like fertilizer. And for Gurdjieff, in terms of organic life as fertilizer, it passes to the moon. So you kind of go back and the elements in you are broken down again. And Gurdjieff says that for someone who passes to the moon, there's still the possibility of evolution. But he says the time period of their evolution is on that time period of the evolution of the solar system. So it would be over a matter of maybe millions and billions of years. Our solar system is currently thought to be 4 billion years old. So if we pass to the moon and these elements break down, there's still the possibility of attaining the soul, but only over this long, long evolutionary period. That's why Gurdjieff says, and that really is of little consequence to the individual. What is of consequence to us is that we can attain our souls within this life. And that's, in a way, the purpose of life, is to attain our souls. And for Gurdjieff, that means to develop our higher being bodies. Jim, I'll let you comment or continue on.
Yeah, well, the story of the nuts is the acorns is really great. You know, so it's just it just puts it in perspective. In keeping with the whole idea of the zero point, so it's interesting how we talked about this before, but how like a seed contains within it all the potentiality to become an oak tree or a human being, or you know, like, I mean, we start out as this like fertilized egg, and it can become, you know, can become a full
human being. Yeah,
it's quite miraculous when you really start to think about it. You know, and to say that all of this is just sort of obeying natural laws. You know, okay, yeah, there's some pain. It's lawful on some level, but again, it's like, what are the processes necessary to inform the evolution? Like, how in a human being, you have all the differentiation of all these cells. You know, how do these cells know to become part of the eye or part of the kidney, or, you know, become a skin cell, or what? You know, like, there's this dynamic interaction going on with fields. Again, this is in Laszlo's book. I don't think he really develops this idea, but he says everything is coming out of the quantum vacuum, you know, and that it informs things. But I think it's more complicated than it's not a single solitary thing. I think there's a variety of different levels on which this is happening, that there are all these fields of information which underlie all manifest material creation and are necessary in any kind of biological form to provide life and intelligence.
So then it's like he has a unitary view in a way. It's like how the Akasha is just the Akasha. He doesn't have the idea that it's seven levels of it.
Yeah.
So he has the idea a human being has a material body, but he doesn't then have the idea, well, there could be an astral body, a mental body, a causal body, a Buddhic body, a monic body, and an atomic body. So Blavatsky is saying, yeah, and we live on all seven levels of this universe.
Yeah.
So there are seven bodies, seven possible.
Yeah.
So, like, he kind of argues it's like he has a dualistic view himself, implicit in a way, because...
Yeah, really, very much so. And I think, in a way, even though he's sort of denying... He gets over the hump of denying how unconscious matter can provide consciousness by saying that everything possesses some sort of level of consciousness. But again, like I say, he sees this all happening in the brain, and that somehow simpler conscious processes of consciousness produce more complex levels of consciousness, which to a certain extent is true. But what's missing, kind of, in, you know, to jump a little bit here, but it's sort of the holographic model is sort of the laser beam, you know, like what is it that's providing the light. And in terms of the heart doctrine, it's that this is originating from higher dimensions and manifesting through the metaphysical and physical heart, which provides the life principle and the principle of consciousness, which illuminates the psychic functions going on in the brain. Like, there's no kind of recognition of any of these things in Laszlo's work, but
actually there is some point. I remember marking it up in my book as I read it. He refers to the inner light, but he doesn't elaborate on it.
He just, in passing,
realize the significance of it.
Yeah. But getting back on, you were talking about Beelzebub's tales, and you said Gurdjieff, but I mean, really, it's Beelzebub. But Beelzebub really is Gurdjieff. Gurdjieff said at one point, you know, I am Beelzebub. You know,
yeah.
It's a very interesting. I'll go off on a little bit of a different thought here. It's like, you know, they say we've been studying this for 32 years, and you talk about, you know, about Beelzebub's tales, which is for those who have any familiarity with the fourth way, there you'll know that you. Gurdjieff presents his ideas originally through lectures, and which are recounted with lectures he presented in Russia in pre-war, pre-First World War Russia, Revolutionary Russia, and Uspensky presents them in Search of the Miraculous, and there's these brilliant, really concise, elegant explanations of things, and many years go by, and Gurdjieff turns to writing, he says, against his will, and he writes this book, Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, which is really quite difficult to read, especially at the beginning. And it is intentionally created that way, but it's a myth. It's an allegory. And he presents things in a much more elliptical fashion. It's not concise and articulated the way that his earlier speeches were, but it's certainly profound. The more you think about it, the more you feel about it, the more you recognize it, and you see that there's these profound ideas in these tales, Beelzebub's tales. And I realized, like, after 32 years that, you know, in the grand total of the Gurdjieff work and what I know of Blavatsky and other Sufism, other esoteric teachings, what really strikes me is that the more you study things, the more you have you understand, the more you know, the more you understand, and also the more you realize how profound these teachings really are. Right? Like,
yeah.
I mean, especially when everything in modern science, many of the questions that are raised in modern science just reinforce how incredibly prescient and insightful these teachings are. These things
yeah.
written hundreds and even thousands of years ago.
Yeah, they just reinforce the teachings.
It all fits, you know. A lot of the things that would have seemed absurd 100 years ago, almost 100 years ago when Gurdjieff was talking about them, are quite consistent now. Or Madame Blavatsky, as you pointed out many times, you know, in 1888, The Secret Doctrine, was describing cosmogenesis in terms of point source singularities and broken symmetries and
seven-dimensional
hyperspace, the evolution of form from formlessness. I mean, you know,
yeah.
everything that would seem absurd in terms of the science of her day is completely been validated in terms of contemporary research, and actually provides, as you point out, like a really profound model of creation, which helps to integrate current scientific ideas, and I think really cast profound light on a lot of the enigmas and mysteries that confront modern science. It's really quite—it's astonishing, yeah, how profound these ideas are. And as I say, that's one of the best things about getting old is that the more you study and study yourself and study the world in terms of these things, that the more you see. The richness.
Yeah, you're always growing in it.
Well,
it's a remarkable process.
Redefining itself and you higher levels of integration. Like, so many of the things that I thought originally when I read about the Rei of Creation, I mean, certain aspects of it sort of appealed to me on an emotional level, and I thought I never had a difficulty with the idea of a multidimensional universe that, you know, that struck me as being reasonable somehow, partly because of my own experience with psychedelics and with sort of my own experiences with altered states. But you know, there were very many parts of it I just thought, well, I'll never ever be able to grasp this or relate to this. And, you know, years later now, I have such a different understanding of things, and I see things, you know, I grasp the insight in so many of the concepts that Gurdjieff puts forward, and so many of that sort of almost throwaway comments he makes about things, you know, that sort of come back to me, and I think, well, okay, you know, like I'm beginning to understand what that suggests. You know?
I think, in part, I love the title of your book on Gurdjieff, and Jim's book is called An Alien Intelligence, because if you understand esotericism, in a way, the intelligence embodied in them are like totally from another dimension, like they're aliens, they're completely beyond kind of the mundane understanding of things. So it's like an alien intelligence. And you, in your book, you use a quote from a philosopher, I forget who it is, maybe you'd recount that. Recount that, how you came to that title for your book.
Oh, yeah. Okay, well, it actually...
And what's the subtitle of your book?
Geez, I don't even know what the title of my book is. It's a big subtitle. It's G.I. Gurdjieff, The Fourth Way, and... the quote, the three brain beings of the planet Earth, which is Gurdjieff's term for human beings. He calls us the three brain. In Beelzebub's Tales, he talks about the three brain beings of the planet Earth. Well, the quote comes from, that's an interesting story, because for a long time...
North Head?
Sorry?
No. Go ahead, sorry.
Okay, no, I was just going to say, like, for a long time, I had a real difficulty, and I was trying to write about Gurdjieff, and I had a real problem, like, I just couldn't sort of get my head around, you know, what exactly I was trying to say about him. I knew there was something kind of missing in what I was trying to say about who he was, because he was a very enigmatic and mysterious person, really, I just couldn't grasp it, you know. Like, and then I read this. I tried for many years to write about him, and I just sort of was stuck somehow. And then I read this thing by Northrop Frye, which is about. It was part of his. He's a famous Canadian literary scholar, and he wrote. He wrote a couple of books about the Bible. One called The Great Code, and I read a series of lectures he had given about. And he's talking about sacred literature, and in that. One of the lectures he gave, he was talking about the Gospels, and he said that that in the Gospels, Jesus is not a historical character in the Gospels, but rather he's and I don't have the access to the quote, but it's like he says something to the effect that Jesus is ahistorical. He's a figure who drops into the Gospels from another dimension of reality, and I realized that. Yeah, that's what, like, that captures, that's what Gurdjieff is. He's like a being who drops into history from another dimension of reality. And I say in the introduction of my book that I use the term alien as it appears in Webster's dictionary, quote, differing in nature or character, typically to the point of incompatibility. And that's how I sort of see Gurdjieff, is that he's different in nature and character to the point of incompatibility with what we understand to be human. And he's an alien intelligence in the sense that he's a higher intelligence. And at the same time, the alien intelligence applies to what we're trying to awaken within ourselves. Like,
exactly.
If we were to know ourselves, if we were to develop these higher states of consciousness that we're talking about, if we were to exist in our higher being bodies, we would be alien to what we are now, and like we would have a different level of intelligence, and in a way, that's sort of what the process of self-study in terms of esotericism is. It's like you're alienating yourself in a sense. Like you're trying to know yourself.
Yeah,
also
you're trying to
alienate yourself from what it means to be human and from the human race as it is in its waking sleep. I mean, in a very real sense. So, yeah, and I mean, I think that, you know, as in literature, there's a big debate in the past 25, 30 years about what they call appropriating voices, you know, whether or not white people can write about black people that, you know, and appropriate their voices, or if men can write about women and appropriate their voices. And it's generally in terms of a majority writing about a minority and trying to articulate through that voice. But it's odd that in Beelzebub's Tales, Gurdjieff appropriates an alien intelligence voices. Beelzebub is a higher dimensional extraterrestrial being of higher intelligence, alien intelligence. And so, like, in a sense, that applies, that's another way that the title of my book applies to him, is that he is an alien intelligence. He speaks in Beelzebub's Tales as an alien intelligence.
Yeah, and the story is so absolutely fascinating. And even down to historic, like, even the questions today about, are there ancient artifacts on Mars?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and how, like, there's many people claim there are.
Yeah.
You know, and that there even have been Martians, or that there are beings on other planets, or other people argue that there are beings on the moon. Gurdjieff said that there are beings who have hollowed out the moon, he says in Beelzebub's Tales. He says they're kind of below in this the moon. And it was amazing, this last week I heard someone speaking, a scientist saying that the density of the moon suggests that it's hollowed out.
Really?
Yeah. I met, it was on Coast to Coast, it was an astronomer talking about kind of the enigmas of the moon.
Has all the green cheese been removed from it? Yeah, well, I mean,
from the point, yeah, you were making, I think that's most important. Like, the esoteric teachings, in a way, like the Gurdjieff teaching, are of an alien intelligence. Like, they're so other than familiar thought and understanding. So it is a kind of higher dimensional understanding. And then there is even deeper aspects to it. Like, over time, I see more and more different questions about Beelzebub's tales, which is so curious, like the historic aspect of it. And I don't know, I mean, back in the early 1900s, you think Gurdjieff was talking about beings visiting planet Earth and interbreeding with us,
yeah.
or the people on Earth, interbreeding with them and mixing among them. And he was talking about these concepts back in the early 1920s. You think how, like, those topics and ideas and such are very contemporary. Like, all those ideas are coming back in. I don't know if you listen to Coast to Coast sometimes, but people talking about aliens and life on the moon and life on Mars and all the enigmas of the solar system. So, but for Gurdjieff, I'm not sure what that sounds like. It just, over time, that Beelzebub's tales to his grandson, it is an alien intelligence, and we as human beings, you can't just read through Beelzebub's tales to his grandson and grasp it. It's not like that. It's something, as you read the book, it develops something in you, a new capacity for mentation, in a way. Develop something in you. The book is designed to help you attain your real I by giving a teaching to kind of awaken your understanding. And
yeah.
I was just thinking, I want to go off, relate, since we're on the tales today of Beelzebub, another kind of, one of the main themes of the book is the science of the soul, and that's kind of the science of the soul and the idea about developing the higher being bodies and how Gurdjieff says we have to do that and so on. And another aspect of the teaching, the reason why Beelzebub visited the Earth from planet Mars, he had to study what were the causes of war, because his grandson says to him at one point about all his tales about the planet Earth. He says what he calls the process of reciprocal destruction, where masses of people go out and murder each other. He says this runs like a crimson thread through the history of humankind. Is this eternal, or not eternal, but endless warfare and kind of mass slaughter and extinction of human beings. And what are the causes of that? And how to kind of break the cycle of humankind and these awful processes of reciprocal destruction, which is like a psychosis which overtakes the human race. I mean, you see that in the world today, the kind of insanity in the world situation. And the endless warfare and just what's happening on the planet. It's astonishing that really lower dimensional forces have really kind of taken over and, you know, we see the processes of reciprocal destruction and we live in a period of crisis in the life of humankind. So the same questions come back to what are the causes of war? What the madness of humankind?
Well, that's one of the wonderful parts of things about Beelzebub's tales to his grandson is that by appropriating this voice of an extraterrestrial higher intelligence, Gurdjieff alienates people from humankind. Like, he provides this history of human beings and he cuts through all the fine words and all the BS with which people kind of glorify history and provides this more objective perspective, and you get this very strong sense of, like, who the hell are these strange creatures, you know, these three brave beings on planet Earth, and he provides, like, I mean, it's also a very funny book. Like, it's an incredible satire on human beings' propensity to aggrandize themselves and to flatter themselves and you know, their lack of modesty and their tendency, as he says, to always perceive reality topsy-turvy, you know, like upside down.
We no longer instinctually sense reality.
Yeah.
And how in humankind there was a development of what he calls a false consciousness system.
Yeah.
And you totally see that in modern times. There's been this complete false consciousness system, in my view, intentionally engendered through the education and media, and there's a whole false, completely imaginary consciousness system has no connection to what the true, we don't understand about the true history of humankind and what the forces really are moving below the shadow governments and elements and elites and so on.
Yeah, I mean, I've said before, I kind of see it like in different terms. They're certainly intentional, unscrupulous, you know, perverted, devious individual psychopaths. But I sort of see them as existing throughout history. But I think a lot of it too is just a low level of consciousness of human beings and their, in Gurdjieff's terms, their willingness to believe any old tale, their susceptibility to being duped their incredible credulity of it to believe just anything. I found that Northrop Frye quote because he's talking about Jesus as he appears in the Gospels, and he says the Gospels are told in terms of myth, and myth is not historical. Jesus is not presented in the Gospels as a historical figure. Rather, he is, quote, a figure who drops into history from another dimension of reality and thereby shows what the limitations of the historical perspective are, unquote. And to me, like, that's like with Gurdjieff, you know, like there's been two major biographies written of him in the English language and many, many remembrances and commentaries on people who knew him and studied with him, and you get all these different angles on him, but I think that anybody who's really honest and really kind of grasped what he was about realizes that nobody really has, Henry Miller said one time about Gurdjieff, nobody's really come to grips with him, and I believe that. And I don't, he disguised himself for his own purposes, so you never really saw him, like Uspensky and all of his earliest pupils said, they never really saw Gurdjieff, and they knew they never really would, you know, that he was playing all these parts externally. But at the same time, Uspensky says, and other people, this playing of parts would be a sign of weakness, but in Gurdjieff was a sign of strength, but not always, because sometimes there was a little too much of it. And even there, it's like kind of this enigma about Gurdjieff is that he was clearly playing parts, but sometimes he's just so over the top that people couldn't fathom any reason why he would be so outrageous or so act in such a strange way. But really, when you look at all his work and you look at the entirety of his life, you realize that I think that he was a higher human being. I think that he definitely attained higher levels of consciousness, and if nothing else, that the profundity of his knowledge and his understanding of things suggests it's an indication of what human beings can become through their own efforts, you know, it's very inspirational in that sense. But at the same time, it's kind of like it's such a deep mystery that you realize that in accounting for things, while addressing him specifically, you realize that the historical perspective is only useful to a certain point, and you have to go beyond the historical perspective to a psychological perspective to really understand, begin to approach him. I don't think we can ever really understand him. But at the same time, there's one thing that Gurdjieff said at one point when he was being very serious, and he said, "I'm a small man compared to those who sent me." And,
yeah, very enigmatic.
I know you love that
comment.
I know you love that quote. And I mean, I think for us who've studied him and realized the profundity of his work, that's really, I mean, it's almost terrifying in a sense. It's like it's such a profound statement. It's like, I was sent on a mission. And I'm a small man compared to those. I mean, wow. Really? You know, like, and that's kind of like Beelzebub in a sense. Like, Beelzebub is a small man compared to those. He's not really a man, but he's a small being compared to those who exiled him.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, because he stuck his nose into something that he shouldn't have stuck his nose into.
That was another theme of Beelzebub's tales, is that, like, Gurdjieff in there says that there are these great saints, or he calls them sacred messengers actualized from above.
He refers
to them, and he refers to Buddha and Muhammad and Jesus and
Shamash, who he particularly
talks about. And these were sacred messengers actualized from above, And they were kind of actualized. The main reason in the book is to stop at different points the processes of animal sacrifice and the slaughter of animals and warfare, the processes of reciprocal destruction, that these sacred messengers have tried to kind of change the course of human history, and how at different times they've had influences, but then Hasnamas, individuals or other forces, kind of brought humankind back to these kind of pathological ways. So it's a fascinating book. Like, you have the sacred messengers who come to Earth, and he talks about how these messengers have some of their messages. They try to awaken humankind through what he calls the three sacred being impulses: faith, hope, and love. And that these were the traditional kind of religious paths and teachings. And we see that in Buddhism and Christianity and so on, the importance of faith, hope, and love. And compassion. And in Buddhism, it's compassion, which would be related to love. And in all the Christian tradition, love, like how does one know the Father? It's through love, you know, and love thy neighbor as thyself. And then the Christian nations go off and commit mass murder, you know, for oil and military power. You know, they think they're doing it in the teachings of Christ. It's so, you know, you see the kind of lunacy, how something so pure becomes so deviated and it's unfathomable what's happened to modern churches, you know, become synagogues of Satan, almost, you know. But anyway, so the idea of there being sacred messengers from above, or an alien intelligences, like higher dimensional intelligences, and that's in the Gurdjieff work and the Blavatsky work, the esotericism in a way presents an alien intelligence, like in the sense we're using that.
Yeah, and I think one of the things, too, in terms of, I was speaking earlier, is in the original lectures, which are published in Search of the Miraculous, and also in a book called Views from the Real World, which were early talks of Gurdjieff, you see that Uspensky once said that Gurdjieff was the finest lecturer he had ever heard. And you just see the brilliance of his speeches and his ability to convey with so concisely these profound ideas. And then, so it's sort of like it's a very intellectual appeal. And for me, when I first studied the Fourth Way, that was one of the real appeals, is reading In Search of the Miraculous. It's like these beautiful speeches. I'm thinking, to me, it felt like this was somebody who was actually talking about something that he understood, rather than intellectualizing and, you know, philosophizing and speculating. I thought this is real. And to me, there was a qualitative difference.
Yeah.
And then in Beelzebub's Tales, like where I say, it's not explicit. It's told in the terms of stories and allegories, and the language is difficult. And there's a very peculiar rhythm to the way that the book is written, and you have to work to sort of digest it. But after a while, you start to get into the flow of it, and you start to understand it, and you realize that in studying Beelzebub, that Gurdjieff really was trying to do something very different, because he wrote another book called Meetings with Remarkable Men, which is very easy to read and which is much more of a standard kind of presentation of a story. And in Beelzebub, I mean, not to oversimplify, but I think it's more of In Search of Miraculous is more of an appeal to the intellect, and Beelzebub is more an appeal to the heart. The first is more of an intellectual exercise. The second is more of an emotional exercise. It's to make you feel like that. When Gurdjieff was writing the book, he was writing it I can't remember. I think he may have written it originally in Armenian or Russian. But
yeah, Armenian.
Armenian. He was having it translated, and he kept asking the translator, what does it make you feel? And so I think really the thrust of In Search of the Miraculous and Gurdjieff's early work was that he was appealing to consciousness, and in the latter work he was appealing to conscience. And he's trying to awaken something in people, trying to crack that carapace that overgrowth, you know, of
that false consciousness.
Yeah, and he has a wonderful metaphor about when he's talking about personality and essence in human beings, he says, you know, the people up until the age of six, they have essence and personality, and essence grows to a certain stage. Essence is what you are, like your disposition and what you're born with and sort of your makeup and your capacities and your talents. And then personality is everything that you acquire through your exposure to through life, like through your family.
Your conditioning. External influences.
Yeah, all external, education, socialization, you know, all the influences. Yeah. And so you know, it grows over, personality grows over essence, and essence becomes like encrusted, eh? And I really like that, because it's like there's this veneer, and then it becomes a crust, and it's so... essence can't grow. It's encapsulated in a sense, and we don't really live in our essence. And so he says, it's, you know, even high-powered people who are very successful in life, people who have highly developed personality, like people who know a lot about things or who, you know, have learned how to be successful in life, they still have the essence of children. And I mean, you look around the world and you see, like, you know, I mean, when I first read that, President of the United States, you know, like was, you know, well, had been Nixon. And in some ways, like, Nixon was a very accomplished person, but, you know, he was also, in some ways, he was a little child, you know, like, I mean, and then Ronald Reagan was a little child, and George Bush is a little child. Like, they all strike me as being very immature.
Yeah, the masters of war are like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, they really are. Like, it's like they want to play Risk with the world. You know, they have this kind of delusional fantasy, what I call the New World Psychiatric Disorder, you know, and they kind of, like, they have these megalomania, and it's like they don't care, you know, they don't care the destruction of the planet and the, you know, poisoning of the population, mass murders of people, and all these things. They have no feeling or compassion. They have no heart. They lose their hearts and soul. See, that's how I see the whole conflict of humankind, is that people from the heart center have become controlled by the three lower centers governing money, sex, and power. And that's the world elites. They're all driven for money, sex, and power. And they don't get to the level of opening the heart, which is the beginning of the enlightened life. So they are so materialistically oriented, like they lose their souls. You see it. You see how these people lose their souls. Like all these bankers who are kind of destroying the United States of America and taking these millions and billions of dollars kind of while people are impoverished and tens of thousands of Americans being turned out on the streets with families and so on. All the horrors of what is being done while these elites take these millions and billions of dollars bonuses for committing fraud in the first place. You know, the whole thing is like so, it's like a mass psychosis.
Pull up the book.
I would never have believed it.
Yeah, but it's interesting though, because you know what you're talking about is like to go back to what you were talking about from Beelzebub. You know, is that periodically, like that's an interesting thing too. Is like he spells out that, you know, there have been these periodic visitations of these messengers from above who try to awaken people and who try to open their hearts, you know, and to try to overcome the rule of sleep, you know. And when you were talking about Ashiata Shamash, was like this supposedly this I mean, some people have said that Ashiata Shamash is Zoroaster, right? But I'm trying to find here, because I think I have somewhere the derivation of his name. But in essence, Ashiata Shamash in Turkish, I think it's in Turkish. Bennett has a commentary about it. He's a solar being. That's what I was trying to say.
A solar being.
He's a solar intelligence who descends into the. Into the earth and you know, tries to enact these reforms in the way that you know, that human beings perceive themselves in reality, and then, you know, he has this effect, and then his work is undone by these Hasnasmus individuals, you know, these psychopaths who keep arising. It's really Historically, it's a very, very interesting book, as you say. Like, I mean, you know, what he's saying about the history of civilization is very much at odds, a very peculiar perspective. But in a sense, like, it provides another worldly perspective on human history, I guess.
It's astonishing. I have another example of this. I have this comment. Like, one thing Gurdjieff is very interesting when he's talking about the origins of Christianity. Mm-hmm. And he kind of says that the origins of Christianity were really in Egypt.
Right.
And it's similar to the newest movie out called Zeitgeist, which kind of shows the similarity of structure of different myths of Zoroastria and Christ and other figures who were all supposedly immaculately conceived and who died, you know, crucified and rose again and things like this. What am I trying to get to?
The origins of Christianity?
Thank you. Okay, and the origins of the Fourth Way teaching. Because he says the origins of the Fourth Way teaching, which Gurdjieff represented, he says really go back to Egypt, but he says to prehistoric Egypt. And he says there was an earlier Egypt that we do not know of than known history.
Yeah.
And here's a recent news item reported by the Associated Press. It announced, quote, archaeologists discovered 2,500-year-old lost cities. The report states that archaeologists had found an intact city submerged in water only 6 to 9 meters deep off the northern coast of Egypt. The ruins are theorized to have been built during the waning days of the pharaohs in the 6th or 7th B.C. The Secretary General of the Supreme Court of Antiquities, Egypt's top archaeological body, describes the finding as the most exciting find in the history of marine archaeology. That was in the Ottawa Citizen in 2001. So there it is. Like, well, there's evidence. Yeah, there was an earlier Egypt that we kind of don't know of. Like, even there, we don't know the history of ancient Egypt. And Beelzebub's Tales has a number of very interesting things like that about the solar system, like the idea, as I was saying before, that there might have been beings established on planet Mars who might have visited the Earth. I mean, Gurdjieff used to visit on a spaceship. In the book, it's called The Spaceship Occasion. And they used to land on the Caspian Sea in this spaceship. I mean, that's pretty ahead of his time.
Well, if you read the history of biographies of Gurdjieff, I mean, part of his search, I mean, we don't really know exactly what he did or where he went, but he traveled widely when he was a youth and well into his late 30s, people, the seekers of truth. And he describes at various points that they visited a lot of archaeological sites and a lot of sites of historical interest to their group, and as well as monasteries and various spiritual centers. But he talks at various points, and you get the impression, this has always been my impression, that eventually he finds this map, which leads him to discover what's called pre-sand Egypt, was actually the term, pre-sand, very, very ancient. And that's how he supposedly discovered the Fourth Way, which he claimed was a teaching which was many thousands of years old, older than Christianity. At one point in Search of Miraculous, he says to Uspensky and to some of his pupils, he said that this can be likened. He said that this is esoteric Christianity. And then he says, if you like, and William Patrick Patterson, who's a contemporary commentator on the Fourth Way, writer of many very, very good books about the Fourth Way, says this is really critical because he says people have taken that and said, well, the Fourth Way is esoteric Christianity. And he said, no. He said, he quotes, he says, Gurdjieff said, if you like. And Gurdjieff, in other places, says that the teaching being presented here is completely independent and self-contained in the sense that it's different from all other esoteric teachings. So the Fourth Way in some ways, a lot of people have tried to say, well, the fourth way that Gurdjieff taught was really a compilation of various other teachings, esoteric teachings. Like there's elements of Sufism, there's elements of Tibetan Buddhism, elements of Coptic Christianity. I mean, all sorts of different things that of theosophy certainly appear in it. But Patterson argues, well, it's people have it backward. It's not that the fourth way is a compilation of these things, but the fourth way is the earlier teaching, and these things are derivative of the fourth way. Whatever. What's really interesting is that you get the distinct impression that Gurdjieff was able to do somehow sort of psychic archaeology, that he was able to have insight into things through his higher powers of consciousness, and that he knew things. I mean, whenever he's talking about these things, what strikes me about his commentaries on the history of civilization, the history of religious teachings, is that there's this authority to what he's saying that I don't think, you know, he was being bombastic or that in any way he was confabulating this. I think he actually knew this. And again, it reinforces this idea that, wow, you know, this guy was really...
Yeah, he tended in ways to minimize it.
Well, yeah,
like
he did.
That comment where he says, I'm small compared with those who sent me. See, he wouldn't kind of want to go around saying, you know, I'm channeling the higher masters.
Yeah, but
he would do the opposite. Like, that's just a passing comment that he kind of hardly ever made.
Yeah.
Otherwise, he kept the origins, who his teachers were a secret. It was unknown.
Yeah,
and what had really happened to him through his 20 years of searching through the Middle East, Egypt and India and Tibet and all over that area, part of the world.
And yet at the same time, like you say, he would say things like, you know, well, Christianity is much older than, there were Christians long before there was Christianity.
Yeah.
And that, you know, he related it to Egypt, as you say, and to the Coptic religion, but much more ancient. He said that he had this whole thing that he said that there had been an Egypt before even the ancient Egypt, which we regard as being ancient Egypt. There was much, much longer. The thing that really struck me from just sort of putting all these different comments he made together, just the feeling is that we really know so very little about the history of ancient civilizations.
Yeah.
You know, that we've just sort of scratch the surface, that there probably was a lot more going on than meets the eye, and there probably was something to the myth of Atlantis that it refers to like a much more ancient civilization.
Yeah.
At one point he says, I think it might be in Beelzebub, where he says that there had been previously highly sophisticated civilizations in human history that were destroyed because of their abuse of electrical technology, something to that. Is that in Beelzebub?
I don't remember that, actually.
Somewhere he says that. He says that they had developed this highly sophisticated technology, but that they had abused it and that it had led to the destruction, which is kind of, you know, when I remember reading that was when the whole threat of nuclear arms escalation was threatening the planet, you know, and it's not, geez, you know, like, I guess we're... Everything that goes around comes around. We're right back to where... Maybe
now with all their new electromagnetic weapons and cell towers and satellites and the whole...
Yeah.
I mean, in Beelzebub's tales, Gurdjieff says at one point is that the extraction of electricity from nature by humankind was one of the causes of the deterioration of the psyche of human beings.
Oh, okay. That may have been what I was thinking of, but I thought he said something else along those lines. But yeah, that's what I was trying to think of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted to just go back to something because I love this quotation from Gurdjieff, and just to take us back, I was referring to your book title, An Alien Intelligence. So
right.
We've kind of given an idea a bit, like Beelzebub's Tales is like that, written like that. It's like this person... is like someone from outside the solar system is kind of giving you this grand overview of the history of humankind upon the planet. And so it provides like an alien perspective on the history of humankind. And in Gurdjieff, in Beelzebub's tales, Beelzebub arrives on Mars even before the crust of the Earth is finally like solidified and the Earth begins to give rise to organic life. So Beelzebub is a character who's kind of like very long life.
Yeah.
But at one point, I love this quote. It's like he taught. It's an investigation of the causes of war, and Gurdjieff explains that at one of his, during one period of his visits to the planet Earth, he says, "I saw this time that without moving from their place, they did with a certain thing, something which resulted in a tiny puff of smoke, whereby a being from the opposite side immediately fell down, either totally destroyed, or with one or other part of his planetary body mutilated or destroyed forever. Such a means of reciprocal destruction I had never seen before." I mean, what he's describing is the invention of, like, rifles or guns.
Someone
did with a certain thing, something which resulted in the tiny puff of smoke whereby a being from the opposite side immediately fell down, either totally destroyed and so on. I mean, it just gives you, like, a kind of a view. It's like an alien intelligence. It's like someone from who's sane.
Yeah.
Like Beelzebub represents someone who has a higher level of reason or intelligence.
Yeah.
And he comes from a solar system, like he's come from a higher dimensional realm, and he's living within our solar system. And he looks at us like holy smokes, these people are insane. And look at this, someone over here does this, and there's this little puff of smoke, and then this other person kind of falls down mutilated. And I think, oh, what would they think of modern times?
The other side of it too is like, he does that with language too when he goes through these, he puts all these terms for things in quotation marks, you know, where he's talking about how we divide up a day, which is composed of what they call, you know, hours, and hours is in brackets, and he tells you all this big thing, and it sounds really impressive, and then you realize he hasn't told you anything whatsoever, you know, but it kind of undermines the usual association to language, you know, and it sort of creates this distant perspective where you go, oh yeah, you know, like, this is how we deal with time, you know, we call it these things, and we name it, and then we think we understand it, you know, it's a very peculiar, clever thing that he does, but like, something like that, yeah, it's like, it's describing the, you know, invention of guns or
yeah, new means of reciprocal destruction.
You say, like, wow, you know, what a strange, like, at one point I said, you know, when I was describing the book, it's like, it's part etymology, like, you know, the study of bugs, you know, like of insects, because he's telling his grandson about his, what his grandson calls his favorites, like his grandson likes the three-brained beings of the planet Earth, these peculiar creatures, so he's telling him about them. But in a way, it's like describing like an ant farm, you know, it's such a strange sensation he creates that in his descriptions of human history and human foibles and follies, I guess. Very, 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 very different. There's nothing quite like it that I know of.
It's a remarkable book. I think its otherness is encapsulated in Gurdjieff's stated intention in the book, which he says is, quote, "to destroy without mercy all the rubbish accumulated through the ages in human mentation." Like, to destroy all this false knowledge that's been passed on, and how human beings have no proper understanding of themselves. There's a completely false consciousness system. They know nothing about the true history of humankind. They, you know, they're out of touch with their essence. Their essences remain at the level of children. I just want to say in passing, I don't ever advertise my books, but one of my books is called The Slugs on G.I. Gurdjieff's Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson. And this is a very unique book, and I have copies of this for sale. It's the only book that I know of that tries, in a way, to present a systematic formulation of the kind of science of the soul elaborated in Beelzebub's Tales.
Yeah,
it's a very
actually,
interesting book.
Having said that, you know, I think it's odd that we're talking about this incredible book that there's very little written about Beelzebub's Tales to his grandson, specifically about that book.
Yeah, there's no book other than Bennett's collected talks.
Bennett has a collected talks book, and I know that some woman, an American, about, I'm thinking like the last 6 or 7 years, wrote a PhD thesis about it. But your book is really, really good. The Slugs is really, really good. It's very, very interesting and is very unique because there just really isn't. It's peculiar that there isn't more commentary about, because there's lots of books about Gurdjieff, but there's very little about Beelzebub's Tales to his grandson. And trying to understand, you know, what the hell is this guy saying in here? Because it's really, you know, it's like, I mean, you could write many books about it. It's quite peculiar in a way that there isn't more commentary on it, you know.
Yeah, it is. It's one of the masterpieces of the last century.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, it's kind of unique in the sense, like, because in a sense it's speculative fiction. It's like it's told in sort of a science fiction, speculative fiction format. It's a sacred book, and it's a satire. I mean, it's a real hybrid of a variety of this, and it's sort of experimental writing too. Like, I mean, you know, James Joyce has nothing on G.I. Gurdjieff in terms of experimental writing. You know, people should you know, if they're interested in hearing or reading some interesting commentary, they should definitely order The Slugs. It's a very, very good book.
Yeah, I have some nice copies I reproduced in New Zealand when I was there with color inside. All the illustrations are colored because I printed them out on myself on a printer and bound them and everything myself. They're $25 if anybody's interested.
Buy one. I don't have an updated copy, so I'll buy
one. Oh, yeah, this is the nicest copy I've ever produced of it.
Oh,
and
nice.
I did another series of edits on it, eh?
Oh, good, yeah.
This is the book I most, I have different writing projects, but I want to go back and reread the tales and do a whole expanded section on, like, Beelzebub's history of the human race, like what he says about how Atlantis and how... See, Gurdjieff in the tale suggests the pyramids and observatories of Egypt were built by descendants of Atlantis who anticipated the destruction of Atlantis, and they, certain ones anticipating this, seeded certain parts of the world, which then one of them was India, which he calls Pearl Land, and another was ancient Egypt, and so on. And then he talks about like how there are vast empires like under the Gobi Desert and fascinating insights into history. Yeah, but I do have copies. Yeah, you'll buy a copy. Okay, I'll send one to you.
I didn't realize that you'd reprinted it. But
yeah, it's a very nice copy. You'll really like this.
One of the things I did in An Alien Intelligence, it was I spent some time talking about, and it's just my own brief commentary on, it's like not a full-scale analysis of Beelzebub's Tales, but I just comment in parts and I draw on some other people's work, but you know, I was actually, that's one of the parts of the book I'm most proud of, is I think because I really tried to, you know, tried to present a brief characterization of what it's about.
Yeah, more detailed, yeah.
Yeah, and it made me realize that just talking about it today, I really want to go back and read it again because it's been a long time since I've reread it, and I just want to. We used to have meetings that from time to time and talk about it, and you know, when you were working on The Slugs. But every time you sort of open it and read it, you get a deeper appreciation. As I say, it's like it's sort of the quintessential esoteric doctrine in that sense, is that you always learn something new.
Yeah, it's amazing these books. Like, I was thinking today, wow, I've written these books, one on the secret doctrine and one on Beelzebub's Tales, which are these kind of two masterpieces of the last century of Western occultism.
Yeah.
And they're really like both like highly profound books.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it could sort of bring this full circle. I would say that as much as we can talk more about Laszlo. I mean, Laszlo is really, really interesting and has a lot to say, but what I don't see in his work, and where I would disagree with Groff's characterization is that I don't see how he has really incorporated, I would say, a lot of the important elements of esotericism, like, and he doesn't seem to be terribly familiar with any esoteric teaching, you know, that where he kind of, you know, provides a framework from
an esoteric, which only deepens his work.
Oh, like, absolutely.
I mean, he has elements of it, the very valuable, how his descriptions of the ether or the Akasha are so profoundly important. And that's the main thrust of the book. And that was the main theme of the Secret Doctrine in 1888, was the main teaching in the Secret Doctrine was that Blavatsky says space, which the scientists think is empty and void, is really the plenum. And that there is a correlation of all forces within the plenum. And she described this plenum or ether as seven-dimensional, seven skins. And, I mean, so, there's so much in my work, I mean, that, you know, that Laszlo doesn't touch upon, the idea of the laws of three and seven, like those are profound ideas. The idea of consciousness connected to the heart. The idea that human beings might actually have a zero-point center. I mean, there's no concept of that in anybody else's work that I know of, other than within a, like if you're a Hindu, you might believe that there's a Jiva Atma within the heart. But people don't think, okay, well, if there is a Jiva Atma within the heart, a spiritual spark described in the Vedas, then there's got to be a science to this. What is the science of this God spark? And that's what my book tries to elaborate, like to look at these questions seriously, relating it to science. And the more you see it, the more you see how science reinforces this idea.
Yeah.
Like even in modern science, like everybody's got this holographic paradigm in psychology. But no one in modern psychology ever thought that there was any source of coherent light within a living being.
Well, I mean,
they lacked that concept, which was the basis of holography.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a recognition of that, but I don't think people believe that because I think people have completely not incorporated that idea. It's astonishing to me that how little the recognition that holographic paradigm has really gotten, and I don't think it's really been developed, you know, the way that you've developed in the last 25 years. I mean, I think there's another element of your work which I think is really profound, because I think the holographic paradigm is very, very important. I think it's a much better model and much better analogy, which can address fundamental enigmas like non-locality that other models can't. I just wanted to respond to something you just said, and now I've sort of lost it. But I want to read something very quickly from Science and the Reenchantment of the Cosmos, which really astounded me. Was that he's talking about Tesla, Nikola Tesla, the maverick genius who was the father of modern communications technologies, revived the concept of Akasha within the modern scientific context. He said there is, quote, an original medium, unquote, that fills space and compared it to Akasha, the light-carrying ether. In his unpublished 1907 paper, Man's Greatest Achievement, Tesla wrote that this medium, a kind of force field, becomes matter when prana, cosmic energy, acts on it. When the action ceases, matter vanishes and returns to Akasha.
Wow.
Yeah, since the original medium fills all of space, everything that takes place in space can be referred to it. He asserted that this Akashic medium, and not the four-dimensional structure put forward at the time by Einstein, is the decisive aspect of space. Tesla. I mean, you know, I was like, that's pretty profound, eh? I mean, I'd like to read that paper, that unpublished paper. I wish I could remember what you said a lot of interesting things there, there was something else I wanted to respond to, but
we've had really wide ranging ideas.
Yeah, we've been all over the place.
Really enjoyed today's talk.
Discussions. My last thought is I was very struck. I know what I was going to say was just in reading The Spiritual Brain by Mariel Beauregard and Denise O'Leary. Beauregard addresses the various people who put forth the idea of that we are hardwired in our brain for spiritual experiences, and that we possess a quote unquote God gene or something to that effect, that there's some sort of physical material structure and process which generates our proclivity to experience spiritual experiences and to have spiritual thoughts and experiences of transcendence and everything. He really takes that apart very nicely. But isn't it odd that that again is kind of like the pathology of the head doctrine, is that people want to find some material process in the brain or some
that produces spiritual experiences.
But they'll deny that this idea of the jiva atma, like that we have a spiritual spark within us, and dismiss it as unfounded. And yet, in terms of the study of consciousness, these people are light years beyond, but through the systematic study of the self, are light years beyond anything in modern science. The modern science, its study of consciousness, is in a word, globally, it's stupid. I mean,
it's in its infancy, it's
childish, really. And I mean, and I'm not denying, because, and Beauregard certainly doesn't. He's a neurologist. I'm not denying the value of the importance, because neurological research is clearly very important, but it's trying to find things like where the light is rather than, where they
where
might
the
actually
is.
See. Again, as I say, in considering these things, I'm kind of having an experience now of being revitalized and re-inspired as I realize it's sort of another step in the octave of learning. Starting to see through things like that. They're really coming together for me now, and I'm starting to.
It's so fun reading other people's material when you have our perspective.
It just opens up
all kinds of things to you that otherwise you just there's certain keys to it.
Yeah.
Mystery keys, like the principles of 137, the heart doctrine, the zero point concept, certain keys to esotericism.
Yeah, exactly. And once you have that framework, once you recognize these things, you kind of see through the false set of assumptions with which people approach basic mysteries and enigmas.
Yeah. So I noticed we're coming. I'm going to just try to wrap up a little bit, and we'll keep on until we must only have a couple minutes left. I would like to remind people, go to my website, www.zeropoint.ca. Please order books. I hardly sell any books. I'm really struggling along to keep up my work. I have no outside funding or support for my work, and really quite struggle here, but pretty determined to keep on with it. I have new edition of God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine, and a new edition of the Heart Doctrine. I'm printing the books myself now, Jim, on my computer.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Has your computter issues been resolved? Or?
Just as of yesterday. It's almost 2 months without it. I'm keen to get back. They couldn't repair my computer. It was going to cost more to repair it than it was worth.
Just buy a new one, yeah.
Yeah, so they gave me a new one and gave me credit for the parts from my old one,
Good.
So anyway, so I'm going to be back. I'm anxious to revise my website again, which I've really let lapse and continue.
Yeah.
I was trying to do a final edition, work with the Heart Doctrine book.
Yeah.
So I do appreciate any support any listeners might want to give to me. Visit my website, and you can also make donations through Pal Talk, through BBS Radio. There's a button there somewhere on the radio site.
Thank BBS again, Doug and Don, for the opportunity. This is a great forum to...
It's been wonderful for us. I mean, and to think that all the materials we've done over the last 3 years now, coming on 3 years, is archived and available to two people. There's a wealth of material there. I had someone the other day, Jim, he's a DJ, and he produces psychedelic music. And he took some of my interview from Coast to Coast, and he has this music, and he puts me on in the background talking and saying, and the song is called Microcosm, Macrocosm, and I'm in the background, and I'm saying, the human being is designed on the same principles of creation as the macrocosm of the universe, and it's produced, it has this big echo on my voice. It's quite good.
Yeah.
I'll send it to you.
Getting a signal that we're supposed to be gone.
Yeah, so maybe we're off even. Okay, so thank you, listeners. I do, for people who want some of my work, go to YouTube and listen to the segments of my interview from Coast. Okay, so we'll be back in 2 weeks. Thanks, Jim Moffat. Thanks, BBS Radio. Remember yourself. Don't be a nut that becomes fertilizer. Try to attain to your soul. Attain to the level of the sun. God bless you all.
Thanks.